The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Null, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
To welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, I present ideas from individuals who would normally not be invited into the official left or right media to share their points of view. But we believe that we need more than just a left and a right. We need progressives, independent thinkers who come from different backgrounds. Today, our topic will be looking at the privatization and decline in American prison system and all the different ways that they manipulate the American public and the prisoners. I'm going to open, before we go to our guests, all of whom are standing by, with The Nation magazine, The Hidden History of ALEC and Prison Labor by Mike Elk and one of our guests, Bob Sloan. The breaded chicken patty your child bites into at school may have been made by a worker earning 20 cents an hour, not in a faraway country, but as a member of an invisible American workforce, prisoners. At the Union Correctional Facility, a maximum security prison in Florida, inmates from a nearby lower security prison manufacture tons of processed beef, chicken, pork for prison rehabilitative industries and Diversified Enterprises, or PRIDE, a privately held nonprofit corporation that operates the state's 41 work programs. In addition to processed food, PRIDE's website reveals an array of products for sale through contracts with private companies, from eyeglasses to office furniture, to be shipped from a distribution center in Florida to businesses across the U.S. PRIDE boasts that its works programs are designed to provide vocational training and improve prison security. And although a wide variety of goods have long been produced by state and federal prisoners for the U.S. government, license plates are the classic example, with more recent contracts including everything from guided missile parts to the solar panels powering government buildings, prison labor for the private sector was legally barred for years to avoid unfair competition with private companies. But this has changed thanks to the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and its Prison Industries Act, and a little-known federal program called PIE, which means Prison Industries Enhancement Certification Program. And while much has been written about prison labor in the past several years, these forces, which have driven its expansion, remain largely unknown. Somewhat more familiar is ALEC's instrumental role in the explosion of the U.S. prison population in the past few decades. ALEC helped pioneer some of the toughest sentencing laws on the books today, like mandatory minimums for nonviolent drug offenders, three strikes laws, and truth in sentencing laws. In 1995 alone, ALEC Truth in Sentencing Act was signed into law in 25 states. Now that's part of an article. Then we go over to another one. This is from John Collins, and it is from, MichiganMessenger.com, and it says the following. Private prison companies' growth went hand in hand with political influence, and I'll quote just two paragraphs. It's been almost 2 years since the privately run prison in Appleton, Minnesota, has held prisoners. But in early 2012, the prison's owner, Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, expects to fill Appleton's Prairie Correctional Facility and another facility in Colorado with 3,256 inmates from California. In the last 10 years, the revenue of CCA, the country's biggest private prison company, has almost doubled, according to their annual reports. Critics say the CCA's success and even the likely reopening of the prison in Appleton stems from their use of lobbying and campaign donations to push through tougher crime laws and increased detainment of illegal immigrants. Quote, prison privatization contracts are designed by policymakers. It's important for these companies to have a political strategy to increase their market share. That's according to Paul Ashton, who you're going to hear from in a moment. Now let me introduce our panel. First up will be Alex Friedman. Alex is the associate editor of Prison Legal News, that's a monthly publication, reporting on criminal justice and corrections litigation. He also voluntarily functions as the vice president for the Private Corrections Institute, a nonprofit watchdog group opposing for-profit privatization of prisons. Alex is a former prisoner, having served 10 years both in public and private facilities for armed robbery and assault in the 1980s, and since his release has been an advocate for prisoner rights and criminal justice reform. He has testified before two state legislatures and before a congressional subcommittee on issues concerning private prison issues. And he is working on his privatelegalnews.org that you can check that out. Following Alec will be Paul Ashton. He is a researcher at the Justice Policy Institute and author of Gaming the System: How the Political Strategy of Private Prison Companies Promote Ineffective Incarceration Policies, which I had the opportunity to read in preparation for this program. Prior to joining the Institute, he spent time as a sexual assault victim, advocate, and conducting research examining intimate partner violence in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual community. Paul's experience with victim issues led him to author JPI's white paper, Moving Towards a Public Safety Paradigm, a roundtable discussion on victims and the criminal justice reform. Paul's also served on the policy committee of the Delaware HIV Consortium. Then we have Bob Sloan. Bob is a prolific investigator researching issues on prison labor, the private prison industry, and its impact on business and society. He is a contributor to The Nation magazine and for the last 8 years has been investigating the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, influencing criminal justice law to increase the incarceration of Americans and the use of the private prison system as a labor force for increasing corporate profits for 300 of the top 1,000 U.S. corporations. His article, The Hidden History of ALEC and the Prison Labor, appearing in the August issue of The Nation as part of the Center for Media and Democracy's expose on ALEC, received the Sidney Hillman Award for Social Journalism. And rounding out our panel will be Cervantes Gauthier. Has been a labor activist since 1965 as a young California farm worker and an organizer of several labor councils and coalitions. He is currently a founding director of the Enlace International, a strategic alliance of low-wage workers and unions, community organizations both in Mexico and the U.S., with immigrant detention among many of its activist projects. And Peter has been a leader in immigrant social justice movements since the early 1980s. I'd like to welcome all of you to this program. We will be taking calls from our audience, which is a worldwide audience, a little later on. But we're going to start with you, Alex, and what I'd like you to do is I want you to lay out the overview so people really understand why this is important, why it's on no one's talking points, why no one in the official mainstream left-to-right media is really talking about this. So let's begin by, how does the private prison industry contribute to the social and economic downturn in the U.S. today? For example, the fact that there's only one market for a private prison industry, and that is the government. So it is a complete artificial market. How so? Let's begin there.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on your show, and I'm glad to be able to address these topics with the other panelists. First, prisons are generally not on anybody's radar unless they are in one or if one of their loved ones or family members is incarcerated. Prison walls not only serve to keep people in, but they also serve to keep the public from looking in. So So the public only really knows about prisons from what they read in the paper or see on TV or in movies, which is often very sensationalized. And they don't really have the concept that our prison system in the United States is more of a business than a government service today, and has been for quite some time, several decades. And it's not a small business either. The amount of money that our government, both on the federal and state levels and local levels, spend on corrections from local jails up to supermax penitentiaries is around the nature of $50 to $60 billion a year. When you have that amount of money floating around, you have companies that will capitalize on it. And due to an increase in the prison population in the United States, mostly starting in the 1980s, and has kind of increased exponentially since then, but somewhat leveled off more recently, a market was created. We had more and more prisoners coming into the system and staying there longer, largely due to the oppressive sentencing laws that you mentioned, truth in sentencing, mandatory minimums, three strikes, and so on, that were promulgated largely by ALEC, which other panelists will speak about later. But the consequence of that is you had burgeoning prison populations and not enough space to house all these prisoners. And so a market was born. And companies, private companies, beginning in the early 1980s, including the industry leader Corrections Corporation of America and GEO Group, which was originally Wackenhut Corrections and has since changed its name, began building prisons and operating prisons for profit. And since that time, in the 1980s, it has become a very large, very involved industry. The top two companies took in almost $3 billion in gross revenue last year. That's GEO and CCA. And private prisons house approximately 8% of state and federal prisoners nationwide, amounting to over 125,000 prisoners. And it has become quite profitable. And this is not only in state and federal prisons, but private prison companies also operate some smaller local jails. They operate detention centers for immigration detainees and juvenile facilities, pre-release facilities, a number. They really kind of intertwine themselves into practically every aspect of our justice system, from operating facilities, providing medical care to prisoners, providing food services, transportation services, commissary services, all of which, of course, is for profit, which means ultimately all these companies that are contracting with government agencies are being paid with public funds or taxpayer funds. It's just like any other government contractor, say for garbage collection or providing educational or medical services to citizens. Part of the difference is in our prison system, companies are being paid to incarcerate and hold our citizens, people who have been accused of crimes or who have been convicted of crimes, and they're detaining them for profit, which is kind of unlike other privatized government services, such as garbage collection or so on, because it's one of our fundamental rights as Americans is life, liberty, and property. And when you start restricting somebody's liberty for profit, that can become somewhat problematic and questionable. For example, if we had a police force that was privatized, and for more arrests, we paid the companies more with the understanding that naturally there'd be a lot more arrests because they make more money, people would see something fundamentally wrong with that. They would say, that's not a good idea. We don't want to be paying companies to arrest people and giving them more money if they arrest more people. They're just naturally going to arrest more people. But there are very strong parallels in our private prison system where we're paying private prison companies to lock people up, and the more people they lock up and the longer that they stay there, the more money they get. And you have the same kind of conflict of interest where the public has an interest in staying safe, in having prisoners be rehabilitated so when they return to society, they will not commit more crimes and victimize more people. But that is not the goal of private companies that operate prisons. Their goal is to make money, just like any company. That is why companies exist, to generate profit for their shareholders and for their company executives and so on. So we have a system now in the United States that, for a large part, is privatized, in many different ways, both operational prisons, transportation, food services, medical care, and so on, and generates profit from incarcerating people.
I appreciate the overview. Now let's look at Homeland Security itself, virtually not regulated, as according to an article in the Washington Post. It's just one of many different agencies engaged in some form of security that a lot of money goes in. People don't know where it goes. In fact, we just posted a Donald Rumsfeld Senate hearing where he acknowledged $2.7 trillion missing, absolutely missing. No one knows where it went in the Defense Department. That was later corrected by a subsequent article showing it was $10 trillion missing. No one held accountable. No one fired. So I'm now thinking these private industries are lobbying Homeland Security for prison reform to benefit themselves and money laundering of tax dollars. Do you have any knowledge in how they lobby different governmental agencies, including Homeland Security, and what it means when then Homeland Security will work with the private for-profit prison corporation, and what that means to the American public?
I can address some of that, and I think our other panelists will also address some aspects of that question. But for the people who don't know, Homeland Security handles a lot of things. It's not strictly like border security or telling us what the alert levels are and so on, and providing security. The Department of Homeland Security encompasses Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, which is the federal agency that handles immigration issues, including particularly immigration detention. So at any given time, ICE incarcerates about 30,000 to 35,000 immigration detainees across the United States. And it's important to understand that a lot of these detainees are not being held on criminal charges. They're not criminals. They are civil detainees. They might have been accused of entering the country illegally, but that is a civil violation, not a criminal one. We have entire families in custody. And it also includes people who are seeking asylum, who are political asylum seekers, and so on. So there's a variety of people who are in ICE custody, which is under the Department of Homeland Security. And there have been a number of issues regarding transparency, both for ICE and for the private companies that ICE contracts with, because ICE holds about 50% of its immigration detainee population in privately operated facilities. And when we talk about transparency, we're talking about the public's right to know what's going on in these facilities, how their money is being spent, and basically to hold government agencies and their contractors accountable when there's problems. But to do that, you first have to know if there are problems or what those problems are. And historically, there has been a great amount of secrecy and lack of transparency when it comes to government agencies contracting with private companies. And there's a very basic reason why. On the federal level, we have a law called the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, which is a very long-standing statute that allows members of the public to put in requests to federal agencies to request information about, well, what the heck they're doing. And that can be budgetary information, it can be operational, it can be policy, it can be a lot of stuff. But it's the way for citizens to understand and see how our government operates and to hold them accountable by requesting information. FOIA does not apply to private companies, even when they contract with government agencies to provide government services. So if ICE is operating its own detention facility, members of the public can file FOIA requests to ask basically what's going on at that facility, what kind of incidents are happening, have there been riots, deaths, what's going on. But if ICE takes that exact same facility and contracts it out to CCA or GO or some other private prison firm, the members of the public cannot file FOIA requests with those companies. FOIA does not apply to them. And in fact, those companies have strongly opposed and lobbied against a bill, the Private Prison Information Act, pending in Congress, and has been for several years, to make them accountable, to hold them accountable under FOIA, to make them have to comply with FOIA requests when they are operating correctional facilities for the government. So they oppose that, and that right now, currently, there is a lack of transparency in ICE facilities. And that, people might not understand how significant that is, but let's put it this way. There was a series of articles in the New York Times a few years back Nina Bernstein, I believe, was the writer, and she detailed the fact that ICE was not reporting deaths. When people die in federal custody, when they're being held and detained, ICE was not giving them the right numbers. And it's very difficult to determine how you're going to get those numbers if you don't get it from the government agency that controls those facilities, whether they're private or public. The private companies that operated ICE facilities where deaths occurred were not forthcoming and provided no information regarding the deaths. So even at the most serious levels, I mean, when somebody dies in custody, that's a very serious event. But even when those type of things occur, there is a great lack of transparency, lack of information coming out of ICE and its private contractors. And that's problematic because the public does have a right to know.
My last question, in what way is the federal government cranking up detentions and incarcerations?
Okay. We have to look at two things. We have the federal government, and the federal government detains people in three ways: through the Bureau of Prisons, which is most federal prisoners, which is the vast majority of their prison population; through ICE facilities, the immigration detainees that I just recently spoke about; and the U.S. Marshals Service, which mostly detains people pending trial on federal charges. Then you have the state systems, and you have, of course, 50 state systems plus the District of Columbia, which have their own corrections department. First, to speak generally, our prison population in the United States has been increasing exponentially almost since the 1980s due to these laws that we discussed, and it has increased to around 2.4 million people behind bars. And that's not all of them. That doesn't include a lot of different types of detainees, civil detainees, military prisoners, juveniles, and so on. But for just state, local, and federal prisoners, about 2.4 million people. That's a huge number of people, and it's unprecedented anywhere else in the world. The United States has about 5% of the world's population, but we have almost 25% of the world's prison population. So we incarcerate a disproportionate number of our population compared to many, many other countries. On the state level, that has actually been narrowing down, has been leveling off, and we actually had a slight downturn in 2009, and I believe in 2010, although I haven't seen those statistics yet. So the state prison population has been coming down or leveling off, and that's largely due to our economic recession right now. States have understood that they cannot continue spending the billions of dollars that they're spending on their prison populations and maintain those populations because they're enormously expensive. And so they're taking steps to control that and reduce the costs, which means their population levels are leveling off. On the federal level, however, the federal prison population has been increasing, and it's been increasing more than the state populations have been decreasing, which means that there's been a slight net increase in 2009-2010. So on the federal level, what's driving the increase in population is increased federal prosecutions. That certainly has not slowed down, but also our immigration laws. So more immigration detainees are being funneled into the prison system and into our detention system, and that is what's largely driving the population on the federal level. Now, private prison companies are capitalizing on this. They have shifted more of their resources away from state prison systems to federal agencies, and particularly ICE. CCA currently gets over 40% of its total revenue from the federal government. GEO gets about 50% of its domestic revenue from the federal government. So regardless of how many states that they work with and how many dozens of prisons they have in other states, these companies are concentrating on the federal market because, well, that's where the money is. And since that's where the funds are and that's where the federal government is wanting to crank up detention, that's where they're going to get very lucrative contracts. And as you mentioned, in regard to market, there is a very limited market for prison privatization. It is a closed market, and it's a market of the government's own creation. Unlike a lot of other businesses, you can't just go out and open a prison and fill it up. Only the government has the power to legitimately incarcerate people and to delegate that authority. So the private prison market has been contracting as the number of companies has decreased. And we currently have a very small market where only four companies in our nation control around 92% of the private prison market. Anytime you get that kind of market concentration, you get a lot less competition, and you get a less benefit to the taxpayer.
Alex Friedman, thank you. I appreciate your input. Let's go over and say hello to Paul Ashton. Paul, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Several issues. Take any in whichever order you choose. One is that a lot of Americans today are unemployed or underemployed because of outsourcing of jobs to other countries. But most Americans are completely unaware that some of their jobs have been lost to 20 cents an hour prison labor. And I'd like for you to address that. Also, why is it that we have such an enormous population in prison compared to other countries? We even have more people than China or Russia or India or Brazil, some of the other countries that are notorious for their legal system not being fair or balanced. And also in that area, why is it that when the Democrats had control of the Senate and the House of Representatives, they did not choose to make any fundamental changes in our sentencing system or our prison system?
Those are all very good questions. I would have to say, you know, here in the U.S., we have this interesting idea of how the prison system and the federal government works in regards to public safety, and that is that here in the U.S., we focus on punishment, on putting people behind bars as opposed to working on any other avenues of protecting public safety, you know, looking at investing in communities or mental health or drug and alcohol treatment prior to the criminal justice system. And so I think that that right there is a large driver in our incarceration rates here in the U.S. But in addition to that, we here in the U.S., it's, as Alec had mentioned and you had mentioned, we have this interesting view in the 90s in particular of passing these mandatory minimums, the truth in sentencing laws, and this legislation so that if you commit crime more than once, you know, the idea is that you should spend your life in prison. And so that's kind of, I think, one of the larger driving forces here in the U.S. I mean, when you compare prison populations between the U.S. and other countries, it can be a challenge because, you know, our corrections model is very different here than it is in Denmark, for instance, or another country around the world. And so I think that these comparisons can be a challenge. Also, you know, when you talk about who we're talking about detaining, I mean China, for instance, I mean, are we talking about political detainees as well? Because I think that number would increase the prison population in China. But then again, we don't measure political detainees here in the U.S. So I think that our policy perspective is what's really driven incarceration in the U.S. As for Democrats choosing not to make changes when they had control, I mean, that's a good question. I would argue that, and what we argue in gaming the system is that the private prison industry, for instance, among many other industries, lobby. They spend millions of dollars each year to infiltrate the halls of Congress and state legislatures to push, you know, agendas that benefit themselves and not the general public. And so I would argue that that has contributed to kind of this outset and lack of reduction in the use of our correction system here in America.
All right, but let's pull back from a moment, look at a larger picture.
Mm-hmm.
There's absolutely no scientific evidence that the longer a prison sentence, whether for drugs or some nonviolent crime, that that's going to in any way deter that person from committing a crime, or that that person, because they're serving a longer sentence, would be less likely to commit a crime when they come out. So this whole idea that when you go away to prison, you have to go for a longer period or lock them up and throw the key away,
mm-hmm.
that to me is just counterintuitive and counterproductive. Also, let's just say someone commits a crime. Let's say you're at a rock concert, you take an LSD, two drops of LSD on a sugar cube. In New York State, they would weigh the sugar cube, and you'd go away for a longer period of time based upon the weight of the sugar cube. That was part of the draconian rules of the Rockefeller statutes. Now, you go to prison, and let's say you've committed no other crime against humanity. You're just an average person. Well, now the likelihood in prison is you're going to be raped if you're a young man. You're going to have to join a gang of some type. In order to stay protected in prison, then you have to live by a code of ethics in prison, which hardens you, and whatever type of spiritual and enlightened positions you have, frequently in most people, it will be like a razor across a person's face. It leaves scars. I've counseled people who've been in prison for nonviolent crimes, and they come out and they say, what was the purpose of putting me in prison? The most violence I've ever experienced in my life was in prison, not out. So we deny that prisons are really there to rehabilitate people. In point of fact, prisons are there either to exploit the prisoner or to punish them. And in that sense, we have people who view the prisoner as an inferior being with really no compassion towards them because they committed some crime. Then I look at the Republicans and Democrats. I look at the corporate America. I look at people who will exchange, let's say, a commodity like food or oil or water, and suddenly people throughout the world are struggling or even dying from starvation or thirst because they can't afford the private water that is now privatized, or the exploitive cost or inflationary cost of food because someone played that market. Those people are not considered criminals. And so our whole concept of what is moral, ethical, what is legal and illegal, I believe, is totally warped. And therefore, if you put all the people who actually cause others to suffer, to destroy the quality of human life, and do so because they have the power to control the laws and rules that allow them to do this, then you would have the majority of people who are in prison today be those of our elite. Those are my personal feelings. I'm not putting upon you, but I'd like for you to address this. What is the purpose of prison to begin with? If we're going to punish people, then don't pretend that it's anything other than punishment. And then at what level does that punishment no longer connect to any social value, but is purely sadistic, where someone is getting off on the power they have to manipulate someone else's life? Your thoughts, please.
I would completely agree with you that our correction system here in the U.S. is not geared towards anything but punishment. We are entirely focused away from anything but rehabilitation. And that's something that the Justice Policy Institute focuses on, and that is our mission here is to reduce the reliance on incarceration in the U.S., primarily because, as you mentioned, criminologists have argued for a long time that keeping people in prison longer does not reduce recidivism, that actually, you know, has the opposite effect, that you're taking people out of the community, you're putting all these collateral consequences on people who are involved in the criminal justice system, so that when they go out into the real world, it's even more harder for them to adjust and to reintegrate into society. On top of that, this notion that we have, I think, is an interesting one in the U.S., and that is, I think, that the general public, you know, the idea behind the correction system is punishment. You know, we don't focus on rehabilitation, and I don't want to necessarily say that the general public doesn't want people to be rehabilitated, but that's, I don't think, the view that we take here in the U.S. per se. It's a very, you know, individually focused mentality that we have sometimes, and so the idea that's been presented to us by policymakers and by other people is that if you break the law, you deserve to be punished. And I completely agree that that's not necessarily the case, because most of the people who are in prison are there for nonviolent offenses and aren't necessarily people who are contributing to serious harm in society.
I appreciate your input, Paul. Let's go over now and say hello to Bob Sloan. Nice to have you with us today, Bob.
Thank you, Gary. Glad to be here.
You're all talking to us, I guess, on Skype, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. Bob, I'm concerned not only with this humongous prison population, but I'm also concerned that we should not have a war on drugs. It's the longest war in American history, it's the most costly war in American history, and it's an astronomical failure. If we would legalize drugs and do so in an appropriate way and provide in every community in America centers where people could seek the help, psychological and physical help they need, then I believe we would do a great deal of good in stopping narco-terrorism in Mexico and America and everywhere else. But also, our prisons would substantially empty out. And I have to wonder, and it's purely a hypothesis, I have nothing to back it up, I'm just wondering out loud how much of the lobbying that goes on between ALEC and the legislators is about getting tougher sentences, cracking down on drugs, getting them into prison for longer sentences, simply because that's profitable. And it has nothing in the world to do with actually looking at the impact of drugs upon people. And if we're going to be that condescending to the truth, why not simply make alcohol once again a drug, cigarette smoking a drug, sugar a drug, caffeine a drug, since they all impact the body and all can have addictive reactions within the biochemistry of the body, and hence put like 99% of the people in jail, How do you think they would change, or do you believe that they would think of that at all, since they think of themselves in such a pious, self-righteous, and noble degree, and the rest of the public be damned? Your thoughts, please. Those are mine.
Well, Gary, what you say there has a lot to the argument. The problem is today with most of the legislators and the influential politicians, corporate owners, they have come to believe that the laws don't pertain to them. They enact all these laws, as we discussed earlier about ALEC, all of these different criminal laws that they have enacted over the years, over the last 30 years, to put more and more people in prison. Unfortunately, it has pertained to the middle class and the lower class specifically, and has not been applied to the upper class or the top 1 or 2%. Every time they get into trouble, they get into hot water, they buy their way out of it, or they get quality representation to avoid imprisonment. So it's basically, it works towards controlling the middle class and keeping them incarcerated rather than allowing any of the people who commit these same crimes but who have a better station in life, they avoid it. So I agree that there should be some application of legalizing at least marijuana and some of the other drugs. This would reduce our prison population immensely. And unfortunately, combating that, you have several factors. You have the guard union. Today, there's a large number of Americans that are employed in the correctional industries. And in that includes private prisons, state prisons, federal facilities, the prison industries and related sections there. So they would very much, and they have, opposed any legalization attempts. We've seen that out in California recently, over and over again, and in other states. But if we did that, it would reduce the population considerably. And when you consider that most of the drug crimes, especially the use and possession, not the sales, but the use and possession of drugs, they're using those to incarcerate thousands of people every year. So when you consider, for instance, in Florida, that an individual who gets caught with, let's say, 20 grams of marijuana, they're subject to a mandatory minimum 5 years in prison for having that amount of marijuana.
Under an ounce.
Under an ounce. And what that translates to, when the public stops and thinks about this, that you are paying as a taxpayer $35,000 a year, approximately, per year to keep that person incarcerated for 5 years.
$170,000 for under an ounce of marijuana.
Yes.
What is the purpose of this? This is insanity.
It is. It is. And what happens is they drive this. They advertise. The mainstream media says, oh, we don't want to release these hardened criminals. We have to keep these people in prison. And all that does is provide fodder for all these different corporations to profit. As Alex said, they're now into food services, canteen operations. They provide medical health care, the private prisons, the transportation, banking. Inmate banking accounts in many states have now been privatized. They're commissary and canteen. So the more people that are in there, the more profits to these different companies. And so when you're paying $35,000 a year or $170,000 for the five-year term for this person that had some 20 grams of marijuana, they've cut all the counseling programs, so they're not getting any kind of rehab or counseling while they're in there. And when they come out, the first thing they're going to do is revert back to the same old peer group and the same old habits. And the next time they get caught, now it's a 10-year sentence because they're a second offender. And it just creates a cycle where these people go in and in and in, and they've eliminated and abolished parole. That was done in 83 or 84 through ALEC. They pushed for that legislation to abolish it. And then they've created numerous laws. I mean, there's just a whole plethora of criminal laws that they have enacted since 1980 to make more acts criminal, to incarcerate more, and at the same time to lengthen the sentences, to make it instead of a 5-year sentence for committing an X crime, it's now a 10-year sentence for the same crime, and no possibility of parole. And then you have the fact of the truth in sentencing, where they must do 85% of whatever sentence the court gives them now. So it just, as he said, as Alex said earlier, it just causes a burgeoning of the prison population. And when you have that many people going in and very little way for them to get out, it's profitable for those corporations that have access to them for their term of imprisonment.
Do you see any irony at all in the fact that President Clinton was a druggie, Bush was a druggie, Obama was a druggie? So the last three presidents have all acknowledged, or it's been acknowledged, they've used drugs. But under today, all three would be doing hard time in a Florida prison. Is there any irony in this? Yet none of those three did anything to try to lessen the burden upon individuals who will be spending that 5 years or longer, and at the problem of the taxpayer, the brutality within that system. And then you have someone coming out on the streets, with rare exceptions, is not going to be a constructive member of society because they've been marked, they've been stigmatized. And I just see that there's rampant hypocrisy from one end of Congress to the other, the Supreme Court, in our media, in the church groups in America, and in both the Democrat and Republican parties. I just believe that unless these people are willing to go into a prison, spend some absolute quality time there — quality means spend the same time as someone that you've allowed to go into jail for smoking an ounce of marijuana or possessing an ounce of marijuana — and see what goes on in their lives, because no one is doing that. And if you're not doing it, then do you have any connection with the laws that you've created? Your thoughts, please.
No, I don't think so. I think, Gary, what happens is the people who write these laws, as we talked about earlier about Alec, we have these corporations such as CCA and Geo Group that for decades were members of Alec, and they supported and promoted any kind of legislation that would make their private prison operations more profitable. And so you have on the other side of the table at Alec from these corporations that want to make more money, and they want these different laws enacted that help them become profitable. On the other side of the table, you have fully one-third of all of the U.S. state legislators on the other side of this table. And so the corporations talk directly to them and say, this is what we want. And the legislators, they turn around and they write the law and put it in the language that would pass in their particular house or General Assembly, and they carry it back to the state, and then they enact it and make it law.
Isn't that a form of political collusion?
I believe it does. I believe it does. And when you look beyond that and you see who's funding this, who's making this available, you know, and look at the millions of dollars that are being spent by these foundations and conservative right-wing organizations to keep this going, to keep all these balls in the air at the same time. It's very, very problematic for our country. And so they're using this this legislation through ALEC across the board. For instance, tort reform. They've made it now so that with all of their legislation over the last 20 years especially, that medical malpractice, there's caps on that. You can only sue under certain circumstances. If there's a death, some of these agencies that are operating on behalf of the state, they get sovereign immunity, so you can't prosecute them. And even if you could settle with them, the most you could get is $100,000 per incident. So they've changed all the tort reform laws to make it harder for consumers and the citizens to recover damages against the corporations who caused that damage or that injury. So on top of all of that, you're adding a situation where you're putting more and more people in prison, and they have no voice. While they're in there, they can't say anything, they can't speak. If they've gotten it part of the tort reform, is that if an inmate files a complaint and says they're working me for 20 cents an hour for this corporation, I think that's wrong. He files a complaint with the federal court, and the federal court comes back and says, well, that's a frivolous action. So once we declare that it's frivolous, you can no longer present anything to any of the federal courts because you've been deemed a frivolous litigator, and it just removes their voice completely. Anybody that would object, if they can find a way to make it frivolous, they do so, and that removes his voice from the conversation.
Well, so, it's just disgusting, in my opinion, Bob, because you boil it down, and what you have is a group of individuals who are very intelligent, very wealthy, very well politically connected, who decide what's in their best interest, make sure that the legislators, many of whom will go to work as lobbyists or in some other capacity of consultation or employment with these very same ALEC corporations, then get the laws that benefit those corporations. That is, well, quite frankly, that is fascism. Fascism is when you have a ruling corporate elite with a ruling political elite who work together for a common good. That's fascism. So that's what we have. And I'm sorry to say that, but I can't see any way around it because I don't see anyone bringing this up as an issue and challenging its legitimacy. Even the fact that we're not aware of what goes on in these ALEC meetings. We're not aware of what goes on at the state level. All I know is that one day, out of the clear blue, I'm given a call saying Texas making Gardasil vaccine that was never proven safe and effective. In fact, 110 girls have died, 25,000 injured, 5,000 serious hospitalizations, many permanent injuries. And yet, they're giving it to all the girls. Well, that had to have been one of these ALEC groups. And we see this over and over again, where suddenly the state legislature passes something, there's been no real time to explore it, and then we realize later, oh, it was one of those issues that was brought up by ALEC. Someone benefited, they met with the legislators, and it gets passed. So we should ban this whole ALEC thing. It's not in any public's best interest to see that there's this collusion between these, the private group for profit, and the supposed representatives of the people. Your final thoughts on this, please.
Well, I agree. ALEC has no place in a democracy. They try to say that they are comparable to the NCSL, the National Council of State Legislators, and they're not. They're totally different. They're totally corporate funded. I think their annual budget is like $7 million, and only $400,000 to $600,000 of that comes from their legislative membership dues. The rest of it all comes from private corporation, Koch Industries, AT&T, State Farm Insurance, Walmart, and as you mentioned, or in particular to what you mentioned, Big Pharma. Pharmaceutical companies and pharmaceutical manufacturers, they all belong to ALEC. And that's where this kind of legislation that you spoke of about the vaccine, that's where this kind of thing comes. That's where the advertising on TV now, that you can see pharmaceutical companies advertising on TV their products directly to the consumer instead of having the consumer get that information from their doctor. And that's how that's done now, because they've lobbied for that kind of expansion of the advertising and the legislation to allow that. So they get these different things passed on these drugs and get them out there. They're one of the biggest groups, corporate groups in ALEC is the pharmaceutical companies, and they impact us, from one coast to the other, state to state. The laws may be a little different in each state, but the laws that ALEC have written and put out to the legislatures in each of these states, the public doesn't get a chance to put a voice in on that. They don't get to say any input. There's nothing they can provide. It's all handled by the legislators. And those legislators that are ALEC members, they go out and they try to get all this stuff enacted. And the corporations drop big money into the campaign contributions of those legislators who aren't ALEC that are sitting on the fence, and they get them therefore to vote for these different laws, and they become law. So when you have that kind of thing happening in a democracy, it is fascism when it's done at this level. and at this volume. I mean, if your listeners would take the moment to go out to alecexposed.org and just review all of the, there's 800 legislative bills out there that were just released and made public in July that come directly from the vaults of Alec. And I think if they would do that and see all of the myriad assortment of laws that have been written that pertain to everything from school education and vouchers to medicinal to the different drugs, all of those different things, ITT, legislation, Second Amendment. I mean, it's all there.
Bob Sloan, I appreciate your input. Our final panelist is Cervantes Gauci. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
I'm going to invite the public now, because we're only going 1 hour and 5 minutes today. So I'd like you to invite your participation, questions, thoughts, comments, challenges, at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Now, if you would please give us your estimate of how much the ALEC groups and the private for-profit corporations in the incarceration business or in any of the policing business are behind a lot of this immigrant legislation, and what it means then to be an immigrant in the United States, because we have people who you will never see, never know their position, but the immigration laws changed because of ALEC and other pro-business organization playing that lobby card. And then the launch of the prison divestment campaign of the two main prison private companies, Corrections Corporation of America and the GEO Group, to denounce the DHS's mass incarceration agenda. Go through this right now, and because it's a big profitable group out there, the illegal immigrants. Tell us about that, please.
Okay, well, it's actually way bigger than ALEC in the States. It's also the federal government. And actually, if you look back to 2005, prior to December of 2005, if you were picked up with a Social Security card, a number that was not your own, in a raid, say, then you would be charged with a misdemeanor, misuse of a Social Security number, which carried a maximum of 1 year in jail and a $1,000 fine. But beginning in December of 2005, we had the big SWIFT raids, and people picked up for the same infraction were no longer charged with a misdemeanor. They were charged with Class C felonies, identity theft, and so forth. That change in the way the law was implemented overnight created over 11 million potential felons in the United States. And so we saw then very few raids, very few incarcerations in 2004. 2005, 2006, they jumped by many thousands, and to the point where, and coincidentally, those people were then started going into these private prisons that got the federal contracts from the Bush administration, GEO and CCA. Their stocks split in July of 96, and their investors more than doubled their money in those two corporations. One of those investors was Dick Cheney at the time, by the way, through the Vanguard Corporation. So it has been a huge business model on the part of the investors in these two companies, who prior to that time were actually not in real good shape financially, and they grew practically overnight with these federal contracts. And then, yes, we have this their lobbying in the states across the country, with all of, starting with Arizona, and then of course we've had the whole series of them, Georgia, Alabama, and so forth, that have also resulted in increasing the number of immigrants incarcerated, all for profit for the investors in these two companies. Every place where an anti-immigrant law, every state where one is passed, you have seen the lobbying activity on the part of lobbyists for CCA and or GEO, and in some cases, some of their major investors. At the federal level, GEO shares lobbyists with Wells Fargo, which is one of its largest investors, and CCA shares lobbyists with General Electric, which is one of its major investors. They are very, very connected throughout the Homeland Security, the Federal Marshal's Office, Bureau of Prisons, Department of Justice, and both Senate and House committees, that they've pretty much been successful in getting contracts to build their business. Over the last 3 years, more than 1 million immigrants have been arrested, detained, and deported in this system. And it's the motive is profit and nothing else. These are people who are harmless. And these two companies make money. Almost all of their income is from our taxes. And the service they provide is putting harmless people in cages. It's outrageous. Most recently, their lobbying efforts have involved partnerships between Homeland Security, Department of Justice, and local towns, cities, counties, etc., to build detention centers for immigrants. We have several fights going on around the country trying to stop this, one most notably in South Florida, in Southwest Ranches, which is a CCA project. But what we've learned is that it is actually these major financial players who are the big investors who have the power in those two companies, more so than even the managements have. And these are some of the same players who got huge TARP fund bailouts, and now they're making money off the taxpayer in this fashion.
I appreciate that input, Peter. It just, however, I have to pull back a little further, and I have to ask a larger, overarching question. It pays to be a big-time criminal. We do not see the people at Goldman Sachs or Bank America or Citigroup or any of these other companies going to jail. We do not see anyone in the last administration that engaged in lies against weapons of mass destruction issues, which has caused over 1 million people in Iraq to die and over 5,000 American soldiers to die. And depending on whose figures you look at, but I choose Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist at Columbia University. He suggests it'll be between $2 and $5 trillion when all is said and done. And yet none of these people are even being held accountable based upon this administration saying, look forward, not back. And yet if someone has an ounce of marijuana in Florida, no one's looking forward. They're saying, you go to jail for 5 years. And it's just incredible who gets away with crimes against humanity, against the environment, against the system. And they are the ones who then write the laws to protect themselves and condemn other people, including nonviolent people, as you suggested, because it's another profit stream. It's very disconcerting. It's very disheartening. Let's say hello to Ron from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Ron. You're on.
Hi. How are you tonight?
Good.
My question is regarding the way the ALEC agenda is pushed in the Congress. There was an article not that long ago in the PR Watch talking about all of the different legislation that Alicanter has introduced right into Congress.
All right. Well, let's ask
the anti-environmental protection laws, rules to protect, to take away protection against health. How does he actually belong? Does he belong to ALEC? Is he an alumnus of ALEC? How does he have the entire ALEC agenda introduced into the Congress like this?
Let's ask that question to Bob Sloan. Bob, would you answer that, please?
Yes, I will. ALEC has 9 task forces that they declare publicly. they actually have a 10th task force. It's called the Federal Forum. And the Federal Forum, basically it's chaired, it's co-chaired by a U.S. Senator and a U.S. Representative, both of which who are ALEC alumni. And through them and the Federal Forum, ALEC introduces their agenda that they're pushing throughout the states. They introduce that right into the halls of Congress. And Eric Cantor and John Boehner are both ALEC alumni. So you can see with that kind of influence and the agenda of ALEC, and as powerful as they are, getting their legislation right up into the halls of Congress and into the ears of the fellow legislators up there, how serious this threat is and how disabling they can be to any kind of negotiations or discussions at the federal level. You know, we saw that in the debt ceiling arguments and the health care and several others.
I appreciate Ron, thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank all of you for being here today. We want to say thank you to Alex Friedman, to Peter Cervantes-Gotchi, to Bob Sloan, and to Paul Ashton. The only way we're going to change anything is become aware of the issue and go to their websites, go to The Nation magazine, download the articles that have been co-authored by Bob Sloan to talk more about ALEC. The Nation's done a commendable job of exposing all of this. And I thank all of you very much for listening tonight. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day, everyone.